Members and guests, please rise for the invocation by Representative Bertoglio and remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Dear Lord, please bless all those who serve in our legislature and the staff that support us as we navigate the issues brought forth to us as leaders. We pray for your divine guidance and enlightenment as we fulfill our responsibilities. May we do so with respect, kindness, and love inspired by you. As it says in Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 to 26, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. We pray this day. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Speaker, 100 members are present.
A quorum is present and the House is ready for business. Are there any introductions? Representative Rickey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is my pleasure today to be able to introduce the pages for this week. So when I say your name, would you please stand? So first is Riley Cruz. Is a junior at Sentinel High in Missoula. Her school activities include cross-country, track, key club, close-up, Model United Nations, and mentoring freshman students through the Spartan Ambassadors Program. Outside of school, Riley participates in youth track clubs, her church youth group, and outdoor activities. She is hoping to attend the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to study education and wants to return to Montana as a middle school teacher. She is sponsored by Representative Grief. Next is Annalise Malaccio. Is a junior at Big Sky School in Missoula. She is a vice president of Key Club, a Health Science Academy ambassador, a varsity athlete in soccer and track, and participates in World Quest and Advanced Orchestra. She also serves on the junior board at Providence St. Patrick Hospital and participates in youth track clubs and church youth group and is a peer tutor. After graduating high school, Annalise hopes to attend the United States Air Force Academy and major in physics, pursuing a PhD, and serving in the Space Force, or NASA. She is also sponsored this week by Representative Grief. Next is Peyton Rickey, is a junior at Billings West High School. He takes civil and electrical engineering classes through the Career Center. He plays first base and is a pitcher for the Billings Halos baseball team. He works at Universal Athletics in Billings. While serving as a page this week, Peyton is interested in getting an inside look at how the legislature works. After high school, he hopes to go to college at Arizona State to become an architect and starting his own business. He is sponsored this week by Representative Rickey. Members of the body are pages. Section, please.
So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So today I would like to introduce my wife, Debbie. She's in the back. She's going to spend the week with us. Thank you, Mr.
Speaker. Welcome to the House. Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Mr. Speaker, I request to be off the record and out of the journal for the purpose of an introduction.
So ordered.
Up in our gallery today, I have some friends and hardworking patriots from Great Falls, Judy and Rudy Tankink. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the House.
Welcome to the House. Representative Logie.
Mr. Speaker, I request to be off the record and out of the journal for a purpose of introductions.
So ordered.
I have some residents from Mineral County that came to watch the process and to speak out front or joined the gathering out front earlier today. I'm not going to say names. We have too many, but there are some up on this side and some on this side. If they please stand. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Welcome to the House. Representative Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to be on the record and in the journal for a special commemorative announcement.
So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On January 25th, yesterday, 1945, Laverne Parrish from Monan, Montana, gave his life for his country after heroically saving the lives of 37 comrades. For his sacrifice, he was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor, and he's buried in Monan, and his spirit lives on in the hearts of liberty-loving Montanans. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Schillinger.
Mr. Speaker, I request to be off the record and out of the journal for the purpose of an introduction.
So ordered.
Yes, I'm happy to be able to introduce to this body my family. It's part of my family anyway. My wife's Carol is up above. She's holding our granddaughter Cass, and my son Brett, and his wife Haley, and Bryn, Bree, and Kenny, the sixth generation of Schillinger farmers in Macomb County.
Welcome to the House. Representative Skies.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May it be off the record and out of the journal for the purpose of an introduction.
So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members of the House, I didn't get permission for this, but there's a new hero of mine sitting in the gallery. Her name is Caitlin Rook, and she's a student here in Helena, and she is one of the strongest, most incredible pro-life warriors I've ever met. God bless you.
Welcome to the House. Order business number one, communications and petitions.
Mr. Speaker, we, your Committee on Legislative Administration, having examined the daily journals for the first through the fifth legislative days, find the same to be correct. Signed, Representative Jedediah Hinkle, Chair. That is all, Mr. Speaker.
Order business number two, reports to standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, we, your Committee on Business and Labor, recommend that House Bill 63 and 117 do pass as amended. Signed, Representative Mark Nolan, Chair. Mr. Speaker, we, your Committee on Judiciary, recommend that House Bill 36 do pass and Senate Bill 19 be concurred in. Signed, Representative Barry Escher, Chair. That is all, Mr. Speaker.
Order business number three, reports to select committees.
None, Mr. Speaker.
Order business number four, messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the Senate to inform the House of Representatives that the following Senate bills and Senate joint resolutions were on this day read three several times and passed title and history agreed to and are herewith transmitted to the House for concurrence. Senate Bill 4, Small, 13, Cone Hour, 20, Cone Hour, 36, Hertz, 53, Wellborn, 61, Flowers, 62, Brown. Sincerely, Marilyn Miller, Secretary of the Senate. That is all, Mr. Speaker.
Order business number five, messages from the Governor.
None, Mr. Speaker.
Order business number six, first reading and commitment of bills.
Mr. Speaker, House Bills 221 through 236 are introduced, read first time, and referred to committee. All are posted. Mr. Speaker, Senate Bills 4, 13, 20, 36, 53, 61, and 62 have been read first time and referred to committee. All are posted. That is all, Mr. Speaker.
Order business number 7, second reading of bills. Majority Leader Vinton.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House resolve itself into a committee of the whole for consideration of business on second reading.
All those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. I appoint Representative Casey Knutson, Chair of the Committee of the Whole for the day.
Members of the committee will please be in order. Members, I just wanted to put a word in here before we get going today. We have some pretty contentious bills, and I just wanted to remind everybody that respect is one of the most important aspects of a legislative body, and although we may disagree, I think we can do so in a respectful manner. So let's just keep that in mind. Members of the committee, you have before you for your consideration House Bill 136. The clerk will read the title of the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 136, introduced by Sheldon Galloway, a bill for an act entitled, An Act Adopting the Montana Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, prohibiting the abortion of an unborn child capable of feeling pain, providing exceptions, providing definitions, and amending section. Mr. Chair?
What is your pleasure, Representative Sheldon Galloway?
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee does rise and report after having had under consideration House Bill 136, that it recommend the same do pass.
Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is my honor and with a strong personal statement that I bring before you today House Bill 136. I would like to show you the highlights of House Bill 136. Section 1 is the title, Montana Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protections Act. Number 2, I will highlight some of the definitions, age of the unborn child, medical emergency, probable gestational age of an unborn child, reasonable medical judgment, serious health risk to the unborn child's mother. Gestational age would now be calculated from the first day of the woman's last menstrual period. Third section is the bulk of the bill. Protection of unborn children capable of feeling pain from abortion. No abortion can be performed on a child capable of feeling pain. When an abortion of an unborn child capable of feeling pain is necessary, it must meet the following criteria. It must be to prevent a serious health risk to the unborn child's mother, meaning offered only if it poses a greater risk to either the death of the pregnant woman or the substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function. This is to ensure also that there is an opportunity to ensure that the unborn child can survive. The practitioner involved in making the determination of the gestational age. Section 4 talks about the penalties. The person performing an abortion after 20 weeks is guilty of a felony. Montana Code Annotated 5020.112. Not to exceed $1,000, imprisonment in the state prison for a term not to exceed 5 years or both. Section 5 tells us that the father or mother can maintain an action against the person who performed and attempted the abortion. The injunction must prevent the person from performing or attempting additional abortions in violation of Section 3 and determines who pays the fees after judgment is made. Section 6 is a protection of privacy and court proceedings. Anonymity should be preserved. Section 7, control of practice of abortion. We have crossed out the wording after viability of the fetus to now say an abortion may not be performed within the state of Montana on an unborn child capable of feeling pain. And Section 8, instructions of the codification. This bill is about the child in the womb and the ability to feel pain, not so much about the father's or mother's rights or the practitioner's decision not to have a child mature to full term. Science has proven that a fetus, an immature human being, or life in the womb can feel pain. It would then be, in my opinion, unethical to intentionally harm an innocent human being in the developmental stages of pregnancy. 20 weeks is equal to 5 months of gestation. A woman should clearly know that they are pregnant long before 5 months. This should help those of you worried about incest and rape issues. The American College of Pediatricians reviews the laboratory and clinical evidence which indicates that as early as 12 weeks gestation, and possibly earlier, exposure to noxious stimuli negatively affects immature human beings. Some argue that for pain to be experienced, it requires two components.
1 minute.
A sensory and emotional conscious component. If this is true, then human beings' ability to experience pain is limited from conception through the first 2 years of birth due to neurological immaturity. Let's picture an 18-month-old falling down and crying. would our response be, stop crying, you're not old enough to feel pain? No, we know that that child is feeling pain. To refuse to acknowledge that a 20-week baby in gestation can feel pain is baffling to me. I stand firm on my statement that it is unethical to harm a child capable of feeling pain. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there discussion? Representative Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Speak to the bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today I rise in opposition to House Bill 136. I rise as a mother, as a sister, as an aunt. Most importantly, I rise as a woman, standing in solidarity with the women who would be disproportionately impacted by this legislation. Women who the data shows already face far too many barriers to access to health care. Women of color, women who live in the rural corners of our state, and working women who are working their best, struggling to make ends meet. I also stand for the women who have experienced violence, and I know that this bill provides no exception for victims of rape or incest, and it explicitly excludes consideration of patients' emotional and psychological well-being. In fact, this bill seriously jeopardizes the safety of women by letting a court decide whether or not to keep their identity private. Under House Bill 136, if legal action is taken, a court gets to determine whether or not the name of the woman will remain private. This public disclosure could further jeopardize the safety of a woman. As it is for many, the dangers of this bill are for me personal. People that I love have been faced with some of the very heartbreaking decisions that this bill contemplates and impacts. I think you guys can appreciate these are intensely private circumstances that place a high demand on women, on their families, and their healthcare providers. When we're navigating some of life's most vulnerable moments, we all wish for and expect privacy and dignity. We deserve to have medical professionals who will be solely focused on providing the best care possible for us, not distracted with worry that their actions will actually put them in jail. House Bill 136 interferes with safe, evidence-based practice of medicine, and it puts government in the role of physician. The experts in women's health have repeatedly opposed this kind of interference because they know that the government has no place dictating how a physician practices or mandating specific treatments. This tyranny has no place in our personal health care decisions, and this tyranny has no place in our state. Please join me in voting no.
Representative Ferris Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body. I speak in opposition to House Bill 136 today. House Bill 136 is a 20-week abortion ban that unquestionably violates Montana's right to privacy and personal autonomy, unnecessarily politicizes safe medical procedures, and invades the doctor-patient relationship. We took an oath this year, as we did last year, to uphold Montana's Constitution. Yet this year and last year, this bill has come out of judiciary. And despite clear language from the Montana Supreme Court that has found this kind of blanket ban on abortions is unconstitutional under our rights to personal autonomy and privacies. These rights are broader than those protected under the U.S. Constitution. So no matter what happens with Roe versus Wade or the new Supreme Court, Montanans still have the right to procreative autonomy, personal autonomy, and privacy enshrined in our Constitution. To that end, the Montana Supreme Court has unanimously held that unless fundamental constitutional rights, procreative autonomy being the present example, are grounded in something more substantial than prevailing political winds, Huxley's Brave New World or Orwell's 1984 will always be as close as the next election. Fortunately, as demonstrated above, the roots of Montana's constitutional right to procreative autonomy go much deeper and are firmly embedded in the right of individual privacy, guaranteed under Article 2, Section 10 of the Montana Constitution. Instead of respecting Montana's constitution, though, this bill, House Bill 36, is an attempt to establish a legal framework for banning abortion in Montana. Although it's couched in healthcare terms, it is simply a politicization of a safe legal medical procedure. It's an effort to establish a state compelling interest in pregnancy and controlling women's health care. And by doing so, it actively alters the delivery of health care in a manner that is detrimental to the practice of medicine, to medical providers, and to patients. HB 136's lawsuit provisions further show that the point is not healthcare, but rather politics. It allows civil litigation to proceed against a medical provider, and by extension, a woman, if an abortion is performed. It specifically allows doctors to be sued for performing abortions. The spouse, parents, or guardians of a minor, prosecuting attorney, or even the attorney general can take civil action. This fundamentally undermines the privacy of the patient-doctor relationship and the administration of a safe, legal medical procedure. At the end of the day, HB 136 threatens the personal safety of women, invades Montana's right to privacy and personal autonomy, and criminalizes the medical profession. For those reasons, I urge you to vote against HB 136 today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I stand in support of this bill because I am a woman who chooses life and a woman who knows that an abortion of a five-month-old preborn baby has nothing to do with women's health, but it has everything to do with the child's health. The premier characteristic of an advanced society is that we value life. If you look at citizens in undeveloped countries, you see that the lives of individuals are cheap and expendable. As Americans and Montanans, we recognize that individuals are important. We recognize the potential of anyone to achieve and improve his or her circumstances. Throughout this pandemic, there has been a repeated refrain of protect the most vulnerable. So I ask, who is the most vulnerable among us? Is it not an unborn child who has no other advocate? Doctors have been studying the ability of the unborn to feel pain for many years, and by now the science is conclusive that they do, even from research by pro-abortion physicians. Babies who must undergo fetal surgery are given anesthesia. Therefore, I submit to this body that we must protect pain-capable unborn children and preserve the lives and dignity of those most vulnerable among us.
Representative Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to speak to the bill. First, something caught my attention that a previous speaker said, and that's that the state has no business getting involved in people's lives, private lives. And I would just correct the speaker and say that there's plenty of times when the state gets involved in the private lives of individuals, especially when the stakes are high. Even things as simple as putting babies in car seats for safety reasons and physician-assisted suicide. I'd also like the body to understand that science and medicine changes over time, right? It's evolving. And some of you are in the demographics that you might remember a time when baby boys were circumcised without local anesthetic. And we don't do this anymore. And the reason that we don't do this anymore is that there was a very famous trial that was done in the late 90s where baby boys were allocated to the experimental group where they got local anesthetic, and then the control group were baby boys without local anesthetic. And the results became so clear that the pain was so excruciating for the baby boys that they stopped the trial on the basis of it being unethical. And so as we further delve into the science of do infants feel pain during fetalcide, I guess is more appropriate term, the answer to that is unquestionably yes. So somewhere around 20 weeks, the cortex of the brain starts to form. And at that point, we believe that there's an emotional component to the pain, not just a physical pain response. And somewhere around 12 weeks is when the fetus starts to feel pain, but not necessarily with an emotional component. In 2020, in the Journal of Medical Ethics, sorry, I'll turn away from you so I can read this for a second. In the Journal of Medical Ethics, the authors were looking actually specifically at this topic about whether it was morally right to commit infant or sorry, feticide on a child, considering what we know now in the science. And here's what they say in the introduction. We consider the possibility that the mere experience of pain without the capacity of self-reflection is morally significant. We believe that fetal pain does not have to be equivalent to the mature adult human experience to matter morally. On that note, I urge you to vote in favor of House Bill 136. Thank you.
Representative Kearns.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to speak to the bill. Thank you. I've heard a previous speaker talk about Article 2 of the Montana Constitution, and I would just like to remind this assembly that the preamble goes as this. We, the people of Montana, grateful to God for the quiet beauty of the state, grandeur of our mountains, and vastness of our rolling plains, desiring to improve the quality of life, equity of opportunity, and to secure the blessings of liberty for this and future generations, do ordain and establish this Constitution. I would ask you to please do support this legislation as it does just that.
Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speak to the bill. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the body, I rise in opposition to this bill and in support of the First Amendment's guarantee of religious freedom. I respect the beliefs of all of you, and I would hope that you would honor mine as a rabbi, a biblical scholar, a former chaplain at hospitals and hospices. Like many Montana clergy, I've counseled families faced with difficult decisions about abortion. The text of this bill, and some of you refer to a fetus as an unborn child or life, assuming that a fetus is a fully human life from the time of fertilization. But that assumption, which is deeply held by some, is subject to profound religious and philosophical debate. It's an issue which we can, in good faith, disagree upon and still honor other views. Although there are many religious and philosophical takes on this issue, I want to share with you the 3,000-year-old Jewish perspective. In the Bible, specifically Exodus chapter 21, which sets out crimes and penalties, it says, and I'll do it in Hebrew, V'chi yinatsu anashim, if men struggle or fight, v'nagfu isha hara v'yatsu yeledeha, and injure a pregnant woman so that her offspring or fruit departs, she miscarries, in other words, v'lo yihya ason, and no other harm happens to her, v'natan biflilim, he shall pay a fine. The text immediately goes on to say, by contrast, the penalty for taking a human life is death. Now, if the Bible believed that a fetus was a human life, the penalty for causing a miscarriage would be that for taking a human life, not a far less penalty of a fine. So our understanding of the Bible's view, then, is that a fetus is not a human life, at least prior to viability. We believe that, to quote my denomination's website, life is sacred, and the life and well-being of the existing life must be prioritized over the possibility of potential life. I'm not asking you to agree with any of this. You have the religious freedom to come to a different conclusion. And if your conclusion mandates that you shouldn't have an abortion, please don't have one. But I ask that you grant Montana's Jewish women and families and others who don't share your view the same freedom of religion to follow their understanding of the Bible and their conscience as you demand for yourselves. In fact, Montana Code currently grants a religious exemption to health care providers who oppose abortion from having to participate in one. The First Amendment requires that we extend religious freedom not only to those with whom we agree, but also to those with whom we disagree. So I want to apply this specifically to House Bill 136, which singles out about 1.3% of abortions that occur after 20 weeks. The vast majority of these abortions are a result of the late devastating discovery of a serious genetic disorder, like congenital diaphragmatic hernia, lethal skeletal dysplasia, missing multiple organs, or serious heart or brain anomalies, and dozens of other genetic conditions with names I can't even pronounce, so that the family will have to watch the fetus suffocate at birth or die soon thereafter. What is pain capable is this bill, capable of causing devastating pain and trauma to Montana families by forcing a fruitless and painful childbirth upon them, only to spend hours or days watching their baby die.
My religion asked me to weigh all these factors and to consult our sacred texts and come to a conclusion based on our tradition, our history, and our ethics.
1 minute.
We reject an arbitrary ban that punishes the 1.3% of families who just learned that their dreams of a child have been shattered. These are precisely the situations to which clergy and doctors bring our expertise, but this bill strips women of their religious beliefs, their right to rely upon sound medical practice, and their right to privacy in order to further an ideological agenda. My friends, many of you promise limited government. You say keep the government out of our lives. Freedom, liberty, individual choice, you proclaim. But this bill would interfere with the sacred freedom of all Montana women and families to make health care and religious choices together with their doctor, their clergy, their conscience, and their God. I urge you to kill this government overreach. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Windy Boy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to speak on the bill. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I had some great pause of getting up and speak on this bill, but you know, in previous sessions, I've always supported pro-life legislation. And for good reason, because I'll give you a little history. When I first came here in the 2003 session, I was called into question by my elders back home of what the difference between pro-choice and pro-life. And at that time, when he asked me about my cultural values, he asked me, do you carry a pipe? I said, yeah. Do you use it? I said, yeah. Well, what do you ask for? So I went down the list. I asked for protection. I asked for good health. I asked for life. And that was all that was needed to be said by my elders at that time. So that changed my whole view of being a pro-life Democrat. And I have, and like I said, I have had my reservations and all this, and this being my 10th session, about my stance on that. But this is a little different here, because ultimately, in whatever religion we are a part of, we are all created equal, no matter what color of our skin, no matter what branch of diocese that we're a part of. And as I speak today on a cultural level, you know, this, if we take a look at this particular item here and take a look at that Constitution, we talk about double jeopardy. This is double jeopardy, because it's not my position to dictate to anybody here who is going to be seeking abortion or whatever, because what this is, what's faced here today, is that these are increasing penalties. Numbers of times over the years in the sessions, I've tried to increase penalties for those men who have domestically beaten their wives and such. Why can't we hold those people accountable for those types of actions? But yet we're standing here, and ultimately, whoever does proceed with this procedure is going to be held accountable, not by us, not by the judiciary, but the big man upstairs in the heavens who oversees everything is in totality. And so what we're doing here, by increasing the penalties on these individuals, that is double jeopardy. And I don't believe that, and since that those previous actions have not gone as far as holding those accountable for whatever actions they've placed upon their fellow human, I think this has kind of gone a little bit too beyond even for what I believe. So for that, I'm going to oppose this one today.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I think that a lot of my colleagues have spoken quite eloquently on the bill as a whole. I just heard a comment that makes it hard for me to not stand up. An argument that an unborn child isn't life. And I just think that that's probably one of the weakest foundations for an argument that I've heard here on the floor. For a while, a pretty decent writer once said that if the term child means anything to us as a society, then the term unborn child has to mean something to us as well. And let's just all be honest with ourselves. If one of our rovers on Mars found a single-celled organism tomorrow, every single headline and every single newspaper on the face of planet Earth would be life found on Mars. So I think at the very least, within the confines of this argument, we should be treating the reality as reality and admitting at the very least that we are talking about an actual life. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Putnam.
Mr. Speaker, would the representative from Great Falls yield to a question?
Representative Putnam, which one?
The sponsor, sir.
Does the sponsor yield to a question?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Putnam.
Mr. Speaker, Representative, does this bill have any provisions in case there is a serious birth defect, such as encephalitis or something that's discovered later in the pregnancy?
Mr. Speaker, thank you, Mr. Pittman. We were just discussing that sitting here. I do not see in the wording of our bill that wording, so I would say it does not.
Representative Skies.
Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for calling on me. I want to rise in support of the bill. I want to stand in defense of the four little individuals that we're talking about. We've heard a lot of great comment today, but I want to bring us back to this bill. The real reason this bill has such a huge following fighting it is because it's the camel's nose under the tent to getting rid of abortion overall. But that's not what this bill is. We've heard over and over that we can choose to behave humanely, but we can't determine what is human. We've had science back us up. We've had emotion back us up. And the discussion seems to constantly revolve around rights of the mother. What this bill is about is that this little organism, I call it a human, this little organism feels pain at 20 weeks. We no longer hang by the neck until dead because it was inhumane. We no longer butcher puppies without doing something to make sure that they don't feel the pain. This bill is about infants feeling pain in the womb as you suck them through a vacuum. That's what this bill is about. Please don't forget what this bill is about. We're saying if we're going to cause pain to a human being, that we should not do it. And we've said it repeatedly throughout our culture. That's what this bill is about. Do not hurt a creature who can feel pain. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There being no further discussion, does the sponsor wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would. From the American College of Pediatricians, immature human beings 20 weeks and older in gestation are not only pain capable, they have an increased sensitivity that makes them more vulnerable to noxious sensory stimuli effects than adults. Medicine's double standard of acknowledging pain capability for wanted premature babies, which we are now resuscitating babies at 22 to 24 weeks of gestation, while we refuse to acknowledge pain-capable, unwanted babies for the same gestational age, is inconceivable to me. We questioned if a baby is defective in the womb, and what I have found in my research is nature has a way in itself to abort those children, unintentional, not intentional by the mother. It is unethical to intentionally harm an innocent, immature human being. Once a fertilized egg becomes a human life, I have not yet seen a human ever deliver a platypus or any other kind of mammal. We have always delivered a human being. I am a Montana woman, a mother, and a grandmother that stands with other Montanans that have asked me to make the right choice today and vote for life. Let's protect those little ones that can't speak for themselves. Since COVID in March, We have had 1,000-plus deaths in Montana. But in that same time period, we have had 1,500 abortions in our state. Now you tell me, who is the most vulnerable? On January 22nd, 1973, the Supreme Court of the United States of America made a decision on a case we know as Roe versus Wade. Today, we have knowledge proven by experiments, research, and exploration that we did not have before for them on that day. I believe, had they had the knowledge and proven science before them, they would have made a different decision. I feel it is time that the laws in Montana catch up to the science of the 21st century. And I will thank you who vote green today on this very, very important bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The question now arises on the motion of Representative Sheldon Galloway that when this committee does rise and report after having had under consideration House Bill 136, it recommend the same do pass. Those in favor of the motion vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Are there absentee votes?
None, Mr. Chair.
Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Chair, 67 representatives have voted aye. 33 have voted no.
House Bill 136 has passed second reading. Members of the committee, you have before you for your consideration House Bill 171. Guests in the gallery, please, no clapping, cheering, anything like that. Thank you. Members of the committee, you have before you for your consideration House Bill 171. The clerk will read the title of the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 171, introduced by Grief, a bill for an act entitled An Act Adopting the Montana Abortion-Inducing Drug Risk Protocol Act, providing requirements for providing abortion-inducing drugs to pregnant women, prohibiting providing abortion-inducing drugs in schools and on school grounds, requiring informed consent, providing for the reporting of chemical abortions and adverse events and complications, providing definitions and providing penalties, civil remedies, and professional sanctions, Mr. Chair.
What is your pleasure, Representative Grief?
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee does rise and report, after having had under consideration House Bill 171, that it recommend the same do pass.
Representative Grief.
Mr. Chairman and members, you have before you House Bill 171, a bill to rein in what has become the Wild West of the abortion industry, and that is the dispensing of the potent inducing drugs through the mail. These are powerful drugs with potentially very serious side effects, including massive bleeding, infections, sterility, and in the most extreme cases, death. They should be taken under the close supervision of medical professionals, not as part of a do-it-yourself abortion far from a clinic or a hospital. When abortion providers began dispensing these drugs through the mail, the FDA stepped in and banned the practice. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the FDA regulation, which is now under review by the Biden administration. If the FDA reverses its own rule, it will once again lead to abortion-inducing drugs becoming the Wild West of the abortion industry. House Bill 171 brings common sense and accountability back to the equation. It protects women by ensuring that they have an examination and a blood test to make sure that they can safely take this drug. It also makes it more difficult for sex traffickers to get their hands on the drugs so that they can force a girl to take them in private to help the traffickers cover their crimes. And it puts an end to dispensing this drug in the schools or on school grounds. The bill has strict reporting requirements so that the government agencies can track the effectiveness of the drug and the number of complications. And this is done with anonymity. All of this is an attempt to keep women safe in an extremely vulnerable time of their life. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to a good debate, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there discussion? Representative Karjala.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speak to the bill.
Go ahead.
House Bill 171 is an unconstitutional medication abortion ban that severely infringes on patient privacy and doesn't do anything to advance patient safety. It violates our state's strong constitutional right to access abortion. Montana Supreme Court in Armstrong v. State held that, except in the face of a medically acknowledged bona fide health risk, clearly and convincingly demonstrated, the legislature has no interest, much less a compelling one, to justify its interference with an individual's fundamental privacy right to obtain a particular lawful medical procedure from a competent healthcare provider. While reminding folks of this decision, it's also important to note Montana Supreme Court reaffirmed the standard set forth in Armstrong in its decision as recently as 2019. Every aspect of this bill represents the type of governmental interference Armstrong prohibits, including a variety of restrictions on medication abortions in Montana. In addition to violating the constitutional right to abortion, House Bill 171 violates the Montana Constitution's right to equal protection of laws. It treats abortion providers and their patients differently than any other provider or patient without justification. HB 171 violates freedom of speech and the right against compelled speech. This bill would force providers to deliver false, misleading, and unproven statements to patients, running afoul of the right against compelled speech, which is a component of the right to freedom of speech. This bill is unconstitutional, it severely infringes on patient privacy, and does nothing to advance patient safety. Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill represents the worst kind of government overreach. It places undue and medically unnecessary barriers between patients and the medical care they need and deserve. House Bill 171 will prohibit patients from accessing medication through the mail, delaying their access to health care and creating barriers to care, especially for those in rural areas. It would even prohibit patients from accessing medication abortion via telehealth when they are in a health care clinic and interacting with a provider at another clinic. There is no medical justification for this, and the prohibition only serves to make it harder for patients to get the medical care they need. The added risk of forcing a patient to be seen in person, as well as subjected to medically unnecessary 24-hour waiting period tests and procedures, is especially cruel during a global pandemic. If enacted, this bill will require a patient to sign a consent form that must include medically inaccurate information, like the list of medically unsubstantiated risks related to the medication procedure and future complications, including sterility. These claims are false and are only meant to scare and intimidate patients. We all want to protect patient safety, but the reality is that medication abortions are among the safest medical interventions out there. This bill does not improve patient safety. It simply adds unnecessary restrictions in an effort to ban abortion. This overreaching bill will also mandate the reporting of information that extends far beyond what is already required, to an extent that it could risk the safety of patients' health care providers. If passed, the personal and private information of a patient and providers must be deemed public records and must be available to the public, including provider names. Lastly, this bill will criminalize medical professionals. Violation of this bill will lead to a criminal penalty and conviction, fined an amount not to exceed $50,000, imprisoned in a state prison for a term not to exceed 20 years or both. These potential penalties are so extreme that they should be recognized for what they are, an effort to discourage providers from providing abortion care for fear they could spend the rest of their lives in prison for a mistake on a consent form. This bill represents the worst kind of government overreach, and I urge you to vote no on the bill.
Representative Windy Boy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I have a question of the sponsor?
Does the sponsor yield to a question?
Absolutely.
Representative Windy Boy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, when I go through some of this stuff here, the first thing that I turn to is on the last page of the fiscal note, and that's where my lines of questions will be. On the technical notes there, you'll see, first of all, first question would be that I see that you didn't sign the fiscal note, and the second part of the question goes into the technical notes, which states 9.2 of HB 171 specifies detailed information that must be reported to DPHS following a chemical-induced abortion, including the pregnant woman's age, race, county, state, and country of residence. However, Section 9.3 prohibits the reports from containing other information of identifiers that would make it possible to identify a woman who obtains a chemical-induced abortion. Section 9.10 of the bill prohibits DPHS from maintaining statistics information that may reveal the identity of a woman obtaining a chemical-induced abortion. These provisions appear to conflict with one another because in rural counties, the information required to be reported may be enough to identify the woman. Number two of the technical notes goes further on saying the Montana Abortion Control Act, Montana Code, blah, 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 regulates information, consent, reporting requirements, and information that must be furnished by DPHHS on abortions. It is unclear whether HB 171 requirements for informed consent and materials to be provided by HHS are intended to control over the current requirements of the Act. Can you elaborate on what those technical notes are, and why should I vote for this?
My friend across the aisle, this bill in no way intends to invade the privacy of women, and steps have been taken in the reporting that the names of the women will not be disclosed. Why should you vote for this, my friend? This drug is one of the most dangerous there is, and yet it could come to a mail order drug again. I have seen horror stories of women going through this alone, desperately needing the help of medical professionals that aren't there because the drug came by mail.
Representative Windy Boy.
Mr. Chairman, can I speak on the bill?
Representative Windy Boy.
You know, this series of bills here today looking at it just kind of blows my mind. You know, in the past we have other issues with previous legislatures that addresses some of these, but you know, when we start reading technical notes of what's out there, you know, it really gives me heartburn as far as trying to support a lot of this stuff. And I, for one, have always been one that on the side of the aisle that supports these things. But it just don't make any sense when you can't explain what a technical note is and what it means and what the bill is trying to accomplish here. So this is probably another bill that I'm going to have to oppose, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I stand before you in opposition of Bill 171 today. I feel with our current pandemic creating unnecessary barriers in Indian Country will cause more damage than intended. Telehealth services allow vulnerable patients to avoid hundreds of miles of traveling across Indian Country. Receiving that care at home means that immunocompromised or COVID sufferers or otherwise emotionally distraught persons can receive care in the safety and surroundings of their home. Digital medicine brings Indian health services into the 21st century. I would also like to speak to the voices that have been forgotten during this pandemic. the voices of those currently in our community, the voices of those kids with parents struggling to put food on the table, the voices of those kids with parents struggling to keep a roof over their head. I hope that we can find common ground and work together to prioritize those young voices already in our communities. Thank you.
Representative Rexton.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak to the bill.
Representative Rexton.
As a chemistry student myself, graduated in chemistry, these drugs are really dangerous. This bill does protect the health of the mother, and it does ensure that it's overseen by a medical personnel that can supervise this procedure. You can't even get a prescription for an antibiotic without a doctor. And this drug, if given in the wrong time of the pregnancy, can cause potential death of the mother. I would ask that you look at the health of the mother in this situation and take that into account. So this bill does protect the health of the mother. And I think we ought to look at that in light of every other prescription that we get from doctors and medical personnel. And this could cause a lot of bleeding, could cause death in certain cases, and it needs to be overseen by medical personnel. Thank you.
Representative Rickey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't be long. I'm always brief. I just want to make one point, and we will always disagree on when life begins. But I'm going to stand here and tell you that regardless of what we believe on when life begins, if there isn't human interference from conception, that fetus will develop into a healthy baby and that is delivered. It is us humans that want to put our hand in that and try and change it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to speak to this bill. House Bill 171 requires standard procedures and safety protocols to be followed. It does not ban any procedure. It requires abortion providers to obtain true informed consent, and it serves to ensure the safety of women. Chemical abortion is not rare, as you heard. As a matter of fact, in the testimony during this bill hearing, we heard that more than 50% of the abortions in Montana are chemical abortions. And unless this bill passes, there will be no accountability in the system that allows a telemedicine appointment with no exam, no ultrasound, no person actually examining the woman in question. And then the mailing of these chemical abortifacients to the woman at her home, to the assumed patient who is not being examined. This leads to some problems alluded to by the sponsor of who's actually ordering this procedure and who's receiving it, and if that person is a willing participant, that needs to be considered. Chemical abortions, it might seem like an easy solution. You get some pills in the mail and it's a done deal, but it's not a simple procedure. One in 20 chemical abortion procedures fail, and 40% fail if it's in the second trimester or later. Diagnostics must be performed for several reasons, because the procedure is only intended for a pregnancy up to a certain stage. And so it matters the age of the fetus, and it matters even more the location of the fetus in the mother's body, which can only be determined with an ultrasound. An ectopic pregnancy is potentially fatal, and without a good diagnosis, administering chemical abortion drugs should be considered malpractice. Patient follow-up, which is required in this bill, ensures the health of the woman. It does not, like I said, ban another this procedure. During this procedure, bleeding can last for weeks. And without follow-up care, there's no way for a woman to know if the pain and the bleeding means that the procedure is working or if there's a potentially life-threatening complication. Additionally, in this bill, women must be warned that there's possibility that she will see fetal remains during the procedure. And this bill requires that warning. That's not a scare tactic. That's a reality of the procedure. And warning them of what's going to happen should just be a standard procedure. Following up with an ultrasound, or at the very minimum, an exam after this procedure should be required also, because it needs to be determined that there are no placental or fetal remains inside the mother, because those can lead to potentially fatal infections. This is not an anti-abortion bill. This is a life-affirming bill that requires safety protocols and informed consent, and it should not be controversial, even for abortion proponents. Abortion is a profitable business, and abortion providers oppose the components of this bill because they hurt their bottom line. But true consent requires information. We cannot even obtain antibiotics without several pages of safety data, warning signs, and potential adverse reactions. Safety in the abortion industry is not a gray area. It is black, and this is not acceptable. I wholeheartedly support this bill. We know for a fact that abortion adversely affects post-abortive women's mental health. Can we at least agree to protect their physical health?
Representative Novak.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members of the whole, I'd like to speak to you today on this bill. I stand before you today and oppose House Bill 171. I'm sure you're thinking that it's just another Democrat preaching pro-choice. But what I'd like to share with you is that I was born and raised Catholic, and I have my own views of what abortion is. And I also firmly believe that pro-choice is not pro-abortion. This fall, I came across a story of a young lady from Texas who was sharing her personal experience. This story has never left my mind. It resonates with me because it hits very close to home. Her and her husband were excited to be expecting their first child. Things were going really well until they weren't. On April 25th of 2016, she had an emergency C-section. Her sweet baby girl was born weighing 4 pounds, 4 ounces. 5 years to the day prior, on April 25th of 2011, I too had an emergency C-section with my twins. Hunter was born first, weighing 4 pounds, 5 ounces. And Gage came 1 minute later, weighing 4 pounds, 1 ounce. They were born at just 32 weeks gestation. I was in really bad shape. They were in very bad shape, especially Gage. I was nervous about everything, and everything was a blur. It was touch and go for hours. It was right about 36 hours before I even got to see or touch Gage. I spent a full week in the hospital, and they spent the next month in the NICU. Yes, that's correct. In 2011, in this day and age, I was hospitalized for a full week after giving birth. The difference between my story and this other gal's story is that I now have a healthy, active 9-year-old, and she had to say goodbye to her sweet little girl after just 30 minutes. In the state of Texas, due to a plethora of anti-abortion laws, it is on record that she had an abortion. This is because the emergency C-section happened within a specific window of gestation. I know how blessed I am that my story is different. I'm forever grateful for the top-notch care we received at Community Medical Center in Missoula, as well as all the follow-up care we received and continue to receive in both Butte and Anaconda. The reality is that while pro-life advocates have their view of what abortion is, many times we fail to see the big picture. What might seem like a moral bill has far-reaching unintended consequences. It should not be our position here today that we're creating legislation restricting any sort of medical care We need to be supporting women, families, and medical professionals and leave those decisions to them. We should be spending our time expanding the opportunity to afford and receive quality health care, specifically in our most rural communities. We should be taking advantage of technological advances and promoting things like telehealth services, not limiting them. This bill is dangerous and it does nothing to promote healthy outcomes. I urge you to stand with me and not let Montana become like other states. Please join me in voting no for House Bill 171. Thank you.
Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak to the bill.
Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you. As brought up in committee, the reasoning why the penalty is so harsh and up to $50,000, and I believe that this is a point that the body needs to hear. Harshest of punishments are for the harshest of people in our society. This would give the authorities the ability to use this extreme, if those are the words you want to use, penalty for those who force young women and young men, or sorry, I guess men can't have an abortion, young women and girls that have been trafficking and the pimps, that they can use this penalty against them in this awful pandemic we have of trafficking. So if that didn't make sense, let me try that one more time. This is the harshest of penalty is on this bill because we have some extreme cases where we want to penalize those people that are trafficking, forcing girls to use these pills that do not have control of their own decision to have or not have an abortion. Thank you.
Representative McCamey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll be speaking to the bill. And the very first thing I want to do is to address my friend in seat 8. One of the reasons that we are for House Bill 171 is because the medical justification for this bill is the safety of the patient, and that patient is a woman. The information that is required to be able to treat a patient is required because they need to have adequate treatment. We don't want to give supposed treatment. There is no one size fits all. As several people have recognized, chemical abortion does not always resolve all of the pregnancy and all of the fetal material that is in the womb. And this is a very dangerous situation because it will require surgery, and then it is essentially a double abortion, and it is causing unnecessary pain to this patient who is a woman. It's important that we realize that this bill does not apply to Plan B or other emergency contraception drugs. The emergency contraception and abortion-inducing drugs are different drugs. The use of mifepristone, brand name Mifeprix, originally referred to as RU486, an abortion-inducing drug under the authority of 21 CFR 314520, also referred to as support, and support H, which was only FDA approval process that allowed the postmarking restrictions. You know, folks, we can't send some of these things ourselves in the mail. We have to declare that we don't have dangerous materials in the post, and that if we do, they do not send it from us. And whereas the use of Mifeprix present significant medical risk, as has been reported before, but not limited to the uterine hemorrhage that can go on for weeks, viral infections, and this has been medically proven, and medical evidence demonstrates that women who use abortion-inducing drugs risk 4 times more complications than those who undergo surgical abortions. This bill does ensure a system of informed consent. The patient can make a more complete decision the better they are informed. This bill does protect the health and safety of pregnant women by ensuring proper access to medical consultation and follows FDA recommendations for prescribing these drugs. Currently, as has been pointed out before,
1 minute.
Women or abusers of women can get these drugs through the mail, but they are also used by human traffickers and domestic abusers. We see some of the worst cases of abuse of women through human trafficking and domestic abusers. This bill ensures that a pregnant woman is provided with the necessary medical information in a transparent manner to make a truly informed decision on medical procedures. Again, this bill does not apply to drugs prescribed for purposes other than to terminate a pregnancy. The medical justification for this bill is the safety of the patient, a woman.
There being no further discussion, does the sponsor wish to close?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the body and my friends, I appreciate very much the thoughts that were shared today and the good debate and the question. But let's return to the bottom line. Abortion providers began sending these potent drugs through the mail, which allowed women to perform a do-it-yourself home abortion with very little medical supervision. And as we heard, these drugs, if used improperly, can cause massive bleeding, infection, sterility, or even death. The FDA realized the problem and stepped in, banned the practice of sending these drugs through the mail. That ban is now in jeopardy as the new administration reviews this rule. This is a woman's safety issue. House Bill 171 will ensure that these drugs are taken under the close supervision of medical professionals only after an examination to ensure the drugs can be taken safely. It also keeps these drugs out of the hands of human traffickers and contains the necessary reporting requirements to allow health agencies to track complications while ensuring the privacy of the patient. Mr. Chairman and my friends, members, this is a good bill. It returns common sense to the equation. It keeps women safe. And I ask you to please vote green. Thank you.
The question now arises on the motion of Representative Grief that when this committee does rise and report after having had under consideration House Bill 171, it recommend the same do pass. Those in favor of the motion vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Are there absentee votes?
None, Mr. Chair.
Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Chair, 67 representatives have voted aye. 33 have voted no.
House Bill 171 is passed second reading. Members of the committee, you have before you for your consideration House Bill 140. The clerk will read the title of the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 140, introduced by Amy Regeer, a bill for an act entitled, an act requiring that a pregnant woman must be afforded the opportunity to view an active ultrasound and ultrasound images and listen to the fetal heart tone of the unborn child before undergoing an abortion, providing exceptions, providing a penalty, and amending sections, Mr. Chair.
What is your pleasure, Representative Amy Regeer?
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee does rise and report, after having under consideration House Bill 140, that it recommend the same do pass.
Representative Regeer.
Mr. Chair, members of the body, House Bill 140 will require an abortion provider to offer the patient the opportunity to view an active ultrasound and hear fetal heart tones. The key to this bill is offer. The patient is not required to view or hear. The provider is required to offer the option. Abortion is a choice in this country, As in many choices made in life, information helps us make decisions. Informed decision-making will provide for less regret in the future. If you will, look with me through the bill. Section 1, line 16, begins the outline as to what the offering is required. To view the act of ultrasound, to view an ultrasound image, and listen to fetal heart tones if audible. Line 21 begins the exemptions. Exemptions being saving the life of the woman if the abortion is done to prevent serious risk to the woman or if done to remove an ectopic pregnancy. Line 26 outlines that the woman's signature will be obtained to verify that she was informed of her opportunities. And then on page 2, line 5 explains the $1,000 penalty should this section of code be violated. And then section 2 just contains the addition that the certification form will be developed for use in accordance with section 1. With any other surgical procedure, informed consent is a major part of preparation for that procedure. For example, when one undergoes a total joint replacement, they are shown the x-ray of that knee or hip to gain insight to what the procedure would accomplish. The more information patients receive about medical procedures done on them, the less anxiety they will experience. At 3.5 weeks gestation, a heartbeat can be heard. At 6 weeks, hands and feet can be seen developing. Helping a woman make the best choice should be the goal of every medical provider, as well as legislator. House Bill 140 will help with that choice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there discussion? Representative Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise today in opposition to this bill. Many leading medical organizations, such as the American Medical Association, the American Medical Women's Association, and the American Public Health Association, oppose procedure-specific informed consent requirements that interfere with the doctor-patient relationship. Requiring that healthcare providers record whether or not a patient chooses to view an ultrasound or listen to a heartbeat is a government invasion into a healthcare decision. This ultrasound stipulation is not medically necessary, nor does it benefit healthcare. The recording and retention of this information is also not healthcare. It is for these reasons I oppose this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Binkley.
Mr. Chair, I would like to speak to the bill.
Representative Binkley.
This bill is about establishing informed consent between a woman and her medical provider. During the hearing, there was a testimony from a woman who had requested to view the ultrasound while she was at an appointment contemplating abortion. It was an ultrasound that was already being performed. I learned ultrasounds are performed to determine the size of the fetus so a proper charge can be made for the abortion fee. She was denied the ability to view the ultrasound. She was not provided proper information to make an informed decision. We're provided documentation for other surgeries and procedures. Why wouldn't we allow women the opportunity to choose to view the ultrasound? If you go to have your teeth pulled, you see the x-ray. If you have a knee replacement, you see the ultrasound or the MRI. When you decide on brain surgery, you see the scans of your brain. Why then would we not allow women the ability to decide if she would like to view the ultrasound? Please allow women the opportunity to choose what is right for them. Please allow them to make good, solid, informed decisions. I am a yes vote on this bill.
Representative Wendy Boy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to speak on the bill. First of all, I want to apologize, Mr. Chairman. It's the third time on a third bill I get up, but I'm not going to excuse myself because, you know, if I have something to say, I'm going to get up and say it. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you know, this is particular another issue that affected the women in Indian country. And when we're talking about informed procedures from a healthcare provider and the patient, you know, this goes back to something that occurred to some of my cousins back in the early 70s, late 60s, around there, where the government had imposed a procedure on them. a forced procedure. And little did my cousins know and my sisters know that what that program was intended to do was an involuntary sterilization program. We don't hear that on here. We don't hear that any place. But when we become a governmental entity that's going to force these types of issues onto people, why start now? We should have started 500 years ago. As a matter of fact, I would ask the sponsor to pull this off the table for today and have a retroactive applicability date, if that's how serious you want to do this, because it is a serious matter. But when we start placing these particular penalties on anybody for the health and safety of an individual, let's speak about the whole scope of races that's been involved in issues that was forced upon them. So again, I know.
Representative Ferris Olson.
Mr. Chair, members of the body, I rise in opposition to House Bill 140, which is rife with constitutional issues. Not only does House Bill 140 run afoul of Montana's right to privacy and personal autonomy, like we've talked about before, but it also has First Amendment implications. While the bill, it's true, only requires an offer of an ultrasound, the fact that it does not require an ultrasound isn't any better. As we all know, the First Amendment of the United States Constitution prohibits the abridging of the freedom of speech. But what we might not all be aware of is the enhanced language that's in the Montana Constitution. Article 2, Section 7 specifically provides that every person shall be free to speak or publish whatever he will on any subject, being responsible for all abuses of that liberty. What this means is that we certainly have the ability to speak our minds, and if we engage in things like defamation, we understand that there may be some reciprocity for that. But what this also recognizes is the correlating responsibility to not allow the government to force individuals to speak, to not compel the speech. And so what this bill does is it undermines the First Amendment and Article 2, Section 7 by requiring a medical provider to speak. In other words, a medical professional is not able to speak whatever he will on any subject. Instead, he or she is forced to speak. And I think it's important to draw a distinction between the examples that were mentioned by a previous speaker and this bill. I am not aware of any law that requires a doctor to share an x-ray before you get a hip replacement. Or, for example, when I had a CT scan, the doctor was not required to show me the CT scan. I wanted to see it, so I looked at it. And I think that's the main difference. This bill forces doctors to tell their patients something and forces doctors to offer an ultrasound. And that is simply just not appropriate in light of our First Amendment and Article 2, Section 7. So I ask you once again to vote against this anti-abortion bill because it interferes with the medical provider's free speech, it violates a patient's rights to privacy, and it compromises the doctor-patient relationship. And so again, I urge you to vote against this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kirk Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise today in opposition to this bill, and I think for me, this is really personal. After this legislative session, my husband and I are planning on starting a family. And I need to know that my rights and my partnership with my medical provider are going to be protected. The problem with this bill is that it seeks to punish women for exercising their legal and constitutional right to an abortion and seeking health care, all while disingenuously claiming to provide women with the information that they need to make a decision. There's no exception for rape or incest. So even women who have undergone unconscionably traumatic experiences must still be told that they can have an ultrasound. Even if the provider already knows that's not what she wants, and even if the provider already knows that this would cause further harm to the woman. It undermines the relationship between a doctor and their patient. That is my biggest concern. I need to know every step of the way that my doctor will be telling me something, will be offering me medically necessary treatment. And this bill jeopardizes it.
Major health decisions aren't easy, especially in the middle of a dramatic or traumatic experience. And to know that the door is open, or as one of our colleagues said, the camel's nose is under the tent. To know that the door is open for politics to guide these decisions makes them even more difficult. The unnecessary requirements of this bill could harm women, especially those who have already experienced harm. And for that reason, I am a no on HB 140. Thank you.
Representative Seekins-Crowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my honor today to speak for House Bill 40. In the early 1980s, my mom, who as an x-ray technician and sonographer, used to use me as her guinea pig, as she practiced scanning my stomach with the new ultrasound machine that our little town's hospital bought. In the 1980s, it was revolutionary that there was this little machine that could present two-dimensional pictures of our miraculous bodies. I could never read the scans, but my mom became an expert. In 1986, mom took a practice scan of one of her colleagues and discovered what was at the time the earliest case of ovarian cancer that had ever been diagnosed. After her colleague's successful treatment, mom, and her name is Kathy, celebrated together by attending their daughter's graduation ceremony. They both cried tears of joy as they watched their daughters walk across the stage. And Kathy, her life had been saved. In 1992, my mom took the first scan of my daughter when I was 8 weeks pregnant. At that time, I could definitely see the heartbeat, and we both cried. In 1994, I remember the feelings of despair when I was told by my doctor that my son was not compatible with life and that I should terminate my pregnancy. After insisting on an ultrasound at my mom's urging, the prognosis was reversed. My son is now 26 years old with two children of his own. In 1995, mom took the scan of my sister's baby and determined that the baby was no longer alive. We all cried on that day as well. By the early 2000s, mom had become a professor, an author, an international speaker, and an expert witness for jury trials. She has shared with me stories of how she has saved people's lives because of the combination of her expertise and the technology. The stories that bring tears to her eyes still are the ones where she recalls when she had to scan women after botched abortions and could see the babies in obvious distress fighting for their lives. But she's also shared other stories with tears of joy because her scans found problems and surgeries on the babies in utero saved those babies' lives. And since that time, the technology has improved and the images are now phenomenal. Even I can tell what I'm looking at now. And that is why I support this legislation. Anytime technology can be used to help women choose their best options in healthcare, it should be used. I've often heard proponents of abortion state that it should be safe, legal, and rare. And if that is truly the goal, then giving women options to use technology to make informed decisions is always the best path. When a woman is at a point in her life where she is contemplating abortion, there's always a lot of emotions involved. It is a decision that should not be taken lightly, and she should have as much information as possible when she is contemplating this life-altering decision. As someone who has watched the progression of the medical technology since its advent, I am thankful that my doctors and I have had this access to make informed decisions regarding my health care. We don't expect women to not have access to technology in any other aspect of their medical care. This legislation allows a woman to choose whether or not she would like to see the ultrasound, and then she may choose whether or not she's going to have an abortion. It is time for abortion clinics to progress into the 21st century and offer the best possible medical treatment for patients. And with that, I do ask for a do pass, please.
Representative Marler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body. This is an emotional topic, and thank you, everyone, for your quorum and good decorum and good debate today. I rise in opposition to House Bill 140. This bill severely erodes the patient-doctor relationship by inserting government into private healthcare conversations. Doctors and other healthcare providers are the people who should decide which services and procedures to offer to a patient, not the government. This bill allows the government to interfere in Montanans' bodily autonomy. Think about that. Do we want to have a government that can tell us that we have to carry a pregnancy to term, or to bully us into carrying a pregnancy to term? What about, as my colleague in the front row alluded to, do we want a government that can involuntarily sterilize people? It's happened to women. Men, how would you feel about that? You go to the doctor, you get some really good information about why you might want to be sterilized, because there's a law that says you need to hear that information. Do we want a government that tells us how many kids we can have? There are governments in the world that tell people the size of their family. Bodily autonomy. Relationship between patients and doctors. This is a bad bill. Montanans value our right to privacy so much that it's enshrined in the Constitution, as many people on both sides of the aisle have mentioned. I urge you to respect privacy of women and people going forward in medical care. And I'll just close by saying to my friends and my family who have had abortions, I'm sorry you have to listen to some of the judgmental language on the floor today. I love you and I respect you and I support you. Please vote no.
There being no further discussion, does the sponsor wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 140 is not forced viewing of an ultrasound. None of the states that have an optional ultrasound have had them overturned in the courts. What is better, consent or informed consent?
The question now arises on the motion of Representative Amy Regeer that when this committee does rise and report after having handed to consideration House Bill 140, it recommend the same do pass. Those in favor of the motion vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Are there absentee votes?
None, Mr. Chair.
Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Chair, 67 representatives have voted aye. 33 have voted no.
House Bill 140 is passed second reading. Members of the committee, you have before you for your consideration House Bill 167. The clerk will read the title of the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 167, introduced by Matt Regeer, a bill for an act entitled An Act Adopting the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, providing that infants born alive, including infants born alive after an abortion, are legal persons, requiring health care providers to take necessary actions to preserve the life of a born alive infant, providing a penalty, providing that the proposed act be submitted to the qualified electors of Montana, and providing an effective date. Mr. Chair?
What is your pleasure, Representative Regeer?
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee does rise and report after having had under consideration House Bill 167, that I recommend the same do pass, Mr. Chair.
Representative Regeer.
Members of the committee, House Bill 167, really the title says it all, an act adopting the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. Born Alive, why we need this? Today, states are making laws allowing for the denial of life when an infant is born alive. State legislation that would make abortion up to and maybe even past birth possible. In Washington, D.C. in 2019, a bill was introduced that would provide protection for infants that are born alive, and it was voted down. This has to be clear in Montana code. You might hear in opposition today that this is already in Montana code. We don't need this. What they're referring to is 50-20-108. And while this is good law, it does not go far enough. It states that when somebody causes the death, who is it that causes the death? The abortionist. It also states that if the infant is viable, who determines if that infant is viable? In that second paragraph of code, it states whenever a premature infant that is the subject of an abortion is born alive and viable. What about those infants that are not a subject of an abortion? If you look at section 4 of this bill, it states that all infants that are born alive, that is the distinguishing factor. All infants that are born alive are protected under this bill. Section 6, it makes reporting mandatory. The healthcare industry must be involved in these protections. And lastly, section 12, we are a representative state. We represent 10,000 or so people from back home. Most laws are done and made right here, but every once in a while, we get an issue that defines us down to the core of who we are, and I believe that this issue is one of those, and I believe that Montanans should have the final say on this issue, and that's what this Section 12 would do, would put it on the ballot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there discussion? Representative France.
Mr. Speaker, members of the committee, I rise today for the first time before this House, and it's a great honor and thrill to be here. I'd much rather be speaking to a bill that brings Montanans together and advances our collective community. But it's important that I speak today on a bill that isn't needed and that divides us. House Bill 167 really is one of those bills that's more in search of a problem. We've heard in committee no instances where born alive infants were subject to procedures. And so as I looked at this bill, I thought, well, as an attorney, I ought to go and understand all the abortion codes of Montana. And while the sponsor cited to Section 50-20-107 and 108, I looked at 50-20-109. And to the question of who defines viability, abortions are prohibited for any viable fetus. Viability is determined by physicians. Who else? The first physician, the treating physician, has to make written findings in his determination or her determination that the fetus isn't viable. He has to have two other physicians concur in that decision and make written findings as to viability. And if that process is not followed, there is a felony. If a fetus, a baby, is born alive and terminated, that's murder in Montana. So, or at the very least, manslaughter. So this is a statute, or this is a bill that is not needed, that it is well covered in Montana's existing law, and it takes a step further by rather than we, a legislative deliberative body, making a decision about what's best for Montanans, we'll move it to a referendum where no doubt we will battle over this bill. We will have a divisive and polarizing debate about an issue that need not come before the Montana voters. So, members of this committee, I urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Lenz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the ability to come and speak on this bill. This bill ensures that unborn infants receive proper medical care and ethical, humane treatment. This bill is about human rights. If medical care is dispensed to all other humans in distress, then it should be provided to born alive human as a result of a failed abortion. We heard in committee this cynical strain that would go through that somehow they didn't just cross that bar. They haven't quite arrived. They're not quite human yet. As someone who spent 24 and a half years at the City of Billings Fire Department, I'm somewhat offended by that because we would give our all to everyone that we came to. We would do CPR on someone who was 95 years old, and yeah, we knew they were in the gray area on their way out, but we would give it our all. And that is what this bill is about, that we would articulate how important this baby is. As a society, we must value our most vulnerable, and we must value life. We should be able to agree that once a child is born, they should be protected, regardless of the circumstances of their birth, Mr. Chair.
Minority Leader Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I rise in opposition to House Bill 167. You know, the claims that are being made here about Montana law not covering this issue just aren't true. We know that Title 50 covers this issue. We also know that this is part of a national strategy that allows politicians to make speeches and deliver rhetoric, but it doesn't actually protect the healthcare that our constituents need. We've seen these bills pop up from Texas to Tennessee to Arkansas, and now one landed here. This is covered We don't need it. We need to be protecting access to care for our constituents. That's what I'm here to do. I'm a no on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise today in opposition to House Bill 167. This one-size-fits-all legislated standard of care not only interferes with medical practice, but denies physicians the ability to provide care that is necessary, compassionate, and appropriate to an individual woman's circumstances. We all deserve access to health care based on our medical needs and doctors' best judgment, not political ideology. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists strongly opposes a similar federal bill and has called it, and I quote, gross interference in the practice of medicine, unquote. Late-term abortions are rare, and they occur in difficult circumstances. This bill interferes with the hard decisions that a woman and her healthcare team must make. Born alive bills are not necessary. A healthcare professional is required by standards and by law to provide appropriate and necessary medical care in the rare case that an infant is born alive after an abortion. I will vote no against this bill, and I hope that my colleagues will do so also. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cheetah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I doubt anyone finds it unusual I'm getting up and speaking on this particular bill. Just remind some of the older folks who have been here and the new folks who are here that it'll be 34 years in March that my number four was a full term but didn't make it from Friday to Sunday. And in some states now, in Virginia, in New York, if an abortion is performed on an infant at that age and they survive, the parents and the doctors get to choose. And in my estimation, there is no choice. We've heard terms like, on certain bills today, tyranny. We've heard words used like judgmental. We just heard a comment about access to care, and so that's what I'm talking about. Decades ago, we were told that a developing child wasn't human but a clump of cells or a blob of tissue. We now know definitively by scientific and technological advances that it is a child. It's the science. Decades ago, technology was less effective at saving a 20-week-old child. We now know that babies born today weighing 14 or 15 ounces are able to be saved and have grown into healthy, productive, happy, normal human beings. Where will the next 20 years take us as more insights are revealed from the great physician? Here's a hypothetical. If any one of us heard the cries of a baby in distress, irrespective of where we or they were, who among us would not try to find and help that child? And the reason for that help on our part is simple. Because of our shared humanity and care for those too vulnerable to care for themselves. Every person, including every child, has infinite value in the eyes of God. Our efforts to twist and bend divine and natural laws to fit our limited vision creates the maladies of our world. We must seek God's will and follow it to the betterment of our world. We're all asked for three areas of obedience to God. That's to know him, to love him, and to serve him. And then we're asked a follow-up question, that is, do we love our neighbor as ourselves? So members, these little ones are fellow members of our human family. How can we not love these little humans made in God's image and likeness? No matter what the circumstances of their birth, whether a full term, a preemie, or a child that survives an abortion, every baby deserves to be cared for. To deny that basic care is to deny our own humanity, which negates our connection to the divine. So in reality, HB 167 is not a Republican bill. It's not a Democrat bill. It's a humanity-respecting bill, and for that reason, we must support House Bill 167.
Representative Stuart Paragoy, did you mean to speak on the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a question to ask of the sponsor.
Does the sponsor yield to a question?
Yes, I do.
Representative Stuart Paragoy.
Mr. Chairman, sponsor, I'd like for the question I have of you is, yes, this bill is about a child that is born alive after it is after an abortion has not has taken place. So my question is, I went through this entire bill. So my question is, Mr. Sponsor, who is the legal guardian of this infant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I just need to correct you real quick. This is not just about an infant born alive after abortion. If you look at Section 4, this is page 2, line 17, it says a born alive infant. So that includes all infants that are born alive. And all infants that are born alive would get the full protection of any human here in the state of Montana.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up.
Does the sponsor continue to yield?
Yes, I do.
Representative Stuart Paragoy.
Representative Regeer, for children who are born alive, because that's what this bill is about, who is the legal guardian?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that'd be the parents.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Does the sponsor continue to yield?
Yes, I do.
Representative Stuart Paragoy.
Representative Regeer, if the parents who are arrested for a botched abortion, who is the legal guardian?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't quite understand your question.
Can I clarify, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Stuart Paragoy.
Representative Regeer, we've heard a series of bills today. And this particular bill is talking about an infant that is born alive. The intent is basically talking about an infant that is born alive from a botched abortion. Now, if you take a look at the collective bills, the doctor or the medical provider or the parents themselves can be prosecuted for inducing an abortion. So in the event that has happened, they've been prosecuted, who is responsible then? Who is the guardian of this infant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so when a child is born alive, or born, it's to the parents. However, in this bill, on page 2, line 22, it says that a healthcare provider who purposely, knowingly, or neglectfully violates Section 4 is guilty of a felony.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Does the sponsor continue to yield?
I'll do one more.
Representative Stuart Paragoy.
Yes. Representative Regeer, I do understand that. But in the event that this child is without any kind of legal guardianship because of whatever the circumstances may be in this situation, according to Born Alive, who is the legal guardian?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's not in this bill. We're not talking about legal guardianship. We're talking about protections for children that are born alive.
Thank you, Representative Regeer. May I speak to the bill, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Stuart Paragoy.
That's exactly my consternation with this bill. When looking at all of these different bills put in place, if the situation arises, we have an infant who is in the hospital with no legal guardian, period. And so we need, so the implication here is that depending on, would they still be a guardian of the state? Possibly. Would they be a guardian and sent to Child Protective Services? Possibly. Depending upon the ethnicity of that child, that's the issue. All of these things are put into play, and we talk about life and protecting life. But what are we doing when that life has nowhere to go, has no one to turn to, has the state taken over? What kind of quality of life is that child going to have? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Majority Leader Vinton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colleagues, I'm guessing that many of you, like me, have had a lot of conversations leading up to today, have had a lot of correspondence, have talked to a lot of proponents and opponents of these bills. It's interesting to me that the opponents always call these anti-abortion bills. And I found it interesting today when I realized this is the third out of four bills we've heard today that are not anti-abortion at all. They're pro-life. I've had lots of media requests this last week. Every single time, these bills are called anti-abortion. It doesn't matter how many times I say, these bills are pro-life, because that's what we're talking about, and in particular with House Bill 167. If a health care provider is required by the standard of care to provide life-saving measures to an infant who is born regardless of the circumstances, then what are we afraid of? Many of you may know that I was proud to carry this bill in the 2019 session, and I am honored to support my colleague from the Flathead in this bill, and I urge you all to vote yes.
Representative Jed Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could speak to the bill. Members of the body, we heard in committee that some say that in the case of a botched abortion that this doesn't happen very often. There's some data presented that said that between the years of 2000 and 2014, there were actually 143 cases of this, but out of only six states that were mandatory reporting. So that's only six states that reported there were already 143 cases of this. In 2002, it was actually called the Born Alive Infants Protection Act of 2002, and we actually saw that, I'll just bring up the Senate on a federal level, actually voted unanimous. All 98 voted, zero unopposed. So it wasn't really all that long ago that we actually came together on this issue. It was only until recently that we started to divide apart. And among that vote in the Senate was a very well-known Democrat senator who has run for president twice, most notably in 2016, with support for similar legislation as this. You know, we're not going to agree on all aspects of abortion. We're not going to, and pro-life issues, we're not going to agree on even post-birth on things like physician-assisted suicide. But this is an opportunity on the area of life where we all can agree, because we have agreed in the past and we don't need that division now. I think this is actually a bill that can bring us together. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, members, 48 years ago, the Supreme Court released their decision on Roe v. Wade. I want to raise a question to the opposition and simply ask, what is controversial about requiring healthcare providers to give medical care to infants born alive during an abortion procedure? Why should we and why would we deny infants who are born after suffering an abortion life-saving medical care? At that point, you go beyond the term abortion. At that point, you're committing murder.
There being no further discussion, does the sponsor wish to close?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It is heartbreaking to hear infanticide referred to as a practice of medicine. Before you is a bill that defines who we are as a state. I know as individuals and political parties, we have our differing ideas on direction, but this goes way beyond that. This really goes down to the question of, are we going to stand for life, or are we going to literally throw it away? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The question now arises on the motion of Representative Regeer that when this committee does rise and report after having had under consideration House Bill 167, it recommend the same do pass. Those in favor of the motion vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Are there absentee votes?
None, Mr. Chair.
Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Chair, 67 representatives have voted aye. 33 have voted no.
House Bill 167 is passed second reading. Members of the committee, have before you for your consideration House Bill 112. The clerk will read the title of the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 112, introduced by Fuller, a bill for an act entitled, An Act Creating the Save Women's Sports Act, requiring public schools' athletic teams to be designated based on biological sex, providing a cause for action for certain violations of the act, and providing an effective date. Mr. Chair.
What is your pleasure, Representative Fuller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move when this committee does rise and report after having under consideration House Bill 112 that I recommend the same do pass.
Representative Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body. House Bill 112, the Save Women's Sports Act, is not a partisan issue, and it's a very simple bill. It's designed to protect opportunities for women and girls in athletics by ensuring that women are not forced to compete against men playing on women's sports teams. The fundamental question is, why do we have women's sports? Men always have physical advantages over females, physiological advantage, and that is the reason we have girls' sports. If men participated on every sports team, we do not need separate teams unless we want to have men's teams and transgender teams. Since the passage of Title IX in 1972, women's sports have been incredibly successful. Title IX is one of the most socially beneficial acts of legislation that the U.S. Congress has passed, in my opinion, right up there with the GI Bill of 1944 and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Fully 96% of female CEOs in today's business world, female CEOs, played competitive sports. Today's athletes inspire tomorrow's champions. If today's females lose to males, are forced to step aside for males, young girls will lose valuable role models. Men hurt women enough. They shouldn't hurt their athletic opportunities.
Is there discussion? Majority Leader Vinton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that House Bill 112 be amended and request Amendment HB 011-2002-001 be posted and deemed read.
So ordered. Majority Leader Vinton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Words matter. And in cases such as this one, sometimes fewer words are better. This amendment eliminates all of the whereas clauses, leaving in place the core intent of the bill. To continue the opportunities and protections made available to women and girls by Title IX. While I appreciate the background information provided in the whereas clauses by the sponsor, they are just that, background information. Let's eliminate the words in this bill that are unnecessary and turn our focus to the true purpose of this bill, which is to continue the protections and opportunities afforded to women like me and like our daughters and granddaughters by Title IX. Thank you.
Is there discussion on the amendment? Representative Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The sponsor regards this amendment as a friendly amendment from the esteemed majority leader. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There being no further discussion on the amendment, would the amendment sponsor like to close? The sponsor has closed. The question now arises on the amendment of Majority Leader Vinton. Those in favor vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Are there absentee votes?
None, Mr. Chair.
Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Chair, 67 representatives have voted aye. 33 have voted no.
The amendment has passed. Is there discussion on the bill as amended? Representative Seekins-Crowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body. Once again, it is an honor to speak on this bill today. If I say the name Michael Phelps, we automatically equate him with his accomplishment of being the most decorated Olympic athlete of all time with 28 gold medals. However, if I say the name Katie Ledecky, even though her family hails from Montana, most of us would not recognize that she is one of the most decorated female long-distance swimmers. In the 2016 Olympic Games, she won 4 gold medals, 1 silver, and set 2 world records. In total, she has won 34 medals in major international competitions. During her career, she has broken 14 world records, but Katie's world record time of 15 minutes, 20 seconds in the 1500-meter freestyle would not even get her near the prestigious events if she were forced to compete against men. The world record for men is 14 minutes, 31 seconds. To put that in perspective, his time is 50 seconds faster, and he would be over 100 meters ahead of her. That means that he would have lapped her in the 50-meter pool. I have heard some comments that men competing in women's events is not really that big of a deal. However, I submit that for those young ladies who didn't make the cut in track to stand on the podium because they were beaten out by young men, For the woman who was severely beaten in the mixed martial arts fight by a man, for the young ladies who no longer have a chance of making athlete of the week because a man has taken the title, and for female athletes who will not have a chance to make the high school or college teams because a male has taken their place, it is a deal. It is a big deal. It is a big deal when someone is allowed to join the team who is not on a level playing field. In fact, their presence, their muscular build, their testosterone levels throughout their development, and their bone structure will keep girls entirely off the playing field. As women's records are being shattered, destroyed, obliterated by men, we are also enshrining gender identity in sports. And that impacts all women, not just in sports, but also in rights, privacy, and safety. We are being told that by allowing men to compete in women's sports, that we've shattered a glass ceiling. In reality, we are constructing an even higher one that our XX bodies will never allow us to reach. And the tragedy is, while these new records are being celebrated, we may never see, experience, or celebrate the undeniably remarkable accomplishments of another Katie Ledecky again. And with that, I ask my colleagues to please give this bill a due pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Phelan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would like to speak to the bill.
Representative Phelan.
House Bill 112 requires K-12 and collegiate athletes to participate under the sex of at which they were assigned at birth. Title IX is a key federal civil rights law that has offered women equal participation in sports and public schools. This law has allowed women's sports to flourish. Previously, women were largely excluded from sports at public schools. The use of drugs to affect physical performance is almost always denounced in athletics. Science has long held that testosterone levels affect performance between biological males versus females. Artificially manipulating testosterone does not change this. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body of the whole. I must say this bill, as presented here today, engendered a lot of email correspondence by all of us, for all of us. And a good portion of the emails that I received in opposition to the bill were in form letter form. It was just cut and paste and sent out, and I'm sure we all know which ones I'm talking about. And I want to say that those emails are important, too, for us to receive from the voting public. The ones that really got to me expressed some heartfelt feelings, many of which those feelings were expressed by our housemate in seat 87. Thank you very much. But I am here today in support of House Bill 112 because I support the integrity of girls' sports in school. Please vote yes on passage of this bill.
Representative Lair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak to the bill.
Representative Lair.
Thank you. I'm a father of an elementary age daughter, and I believe that this bill is integral in protecting Montana women's sports. It allows them to be able to compete in the sport of their choosing and that sport being competitively fair. Thank you, and I urge you to support House Bill 112.
Representative Kearns.
Mr. Chair, I rise in support of this bill, not just as my role, and as you can see, I'm a Lutheran pastor, but instead in another role as a University of Montana student. Here, I get a chance to speak out for some of my classmates who cannot speak for themselves. Those who are on the collegiate teams that risk their scholarships being taken away if they were to come out and speak against this and what's going on with another student. So I would ask you, please, do pass.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body. It feels as though we have a shared goal in this chamber to give Montanans the right to self-determination and the freedom and opportunity to make decisions for themselves. We trust our constituents to know what's best for their health and privacy, safety, education, occupation, and religion. We are collectively working together to expand the liberty of all individuals, and that includes all of our kids, and that also includes trans and non-binary youth who are valued members of this state, whose lives and belonging here we affirm. Our work here is to ensure all Montanans, including trans and non-binary youth, have the ability to live with dignity and respect and have access to opportunities and resources that will let them thrive. This bill is harmful. It's not in line with our Montana values. It's also not in line with the work that we have to do in this chamber. It's not going to make students safer. Instead, it further excludes and marginalizes a group of kids who are already facing bullying, discrimination, and depression. We face deeply urgent priorities in this state, and we have good work to do together. Yet this bill promises no real policy solutions. Instead, it will harm a group of young people already facing serious difficulties. And with that, I urge a no vote on House Bill 112. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Thane.
Mr. Chair, members of the body, I rise today in opposition to House Bill 112. Article 10, Section 1 of the Montana Constitution reads, "It is the goal of the people to establish a system of education which will develop the full educational potential of each person. Equality of educational opportunity is guaranteed to each person of this state." House Bill 112 would open schools and institutions of higher learning to potential lawsuits at the expense of Montana taxpayers. This was true when House Bill 112 was introduced, and it's even more so now that President Biden has signed an executive order directing all federal agencies to enforce the Supreme Court decision in Bostock, which held that discrimination on the basis of transgender status is in fact sex discrimination. The executive order makes clear what this means with regard to the U.S. Department of Education, and I quote, "Children should be able to learn without worrying about whether they will be denied access to the restroom, the locker room, or to school sports," end quote. Violations of Title IX, including those referenced above, could result in the loss of federal education funds to the state of Montana. In fiscal year 2019, that amounted to $484 million in the state. As a former superintendent of schools, I can tell you that schools cannot afford to jeopardize this funding, nor should we be tasked with implementing a bill such as this. Schools should be trusted to act in the best interest of each and every student, and I respectfully request a no vote on House Bill 112. Mr. Speaker.
Representative Custer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, members of the body. I kind of got a different perspective on this bill. It's no secret that I'm older than dirt, and I precede Title IX sports. Why am I telling this, and why do you even care? Title IX came in 1972, so it only affected me for 1 year of my high school career. As a three-sport athlete in high school, and yes, our school had means and some didn't, but we played three sports in high school. But in order to make three sports, I played volleyball. There was boys volleyball, girls volleyball, and co-ed volleyball. And I'll guarantee playing co-ed volleyball, the guys, there were three guys and three girls on each team. And of course, the guys are going to hit it to the girls because we're the weaker link. We know it. I was raised on a ranch. It was no surprise to me that I was a little bit weaker than my brother that was 17 months younger than I was. But guess what? I'm here to, and I'm still here. It was fun. It worked. This bill, I think, is a solution looking for a problem. And why do I say that? Because I called the school board association. They don't even have a policy on this. So I thought, okay, I'll call the Montana High School Association. They rule everything for sports. They tell you when you can practice, when you can't, if you can play, if you didn't practice, all kinds of things. The guy's been there for 24 years, hasn't had an issue on this. This party always says that we're about local control. So I'm thinking the boys that are and girls that are in local control, the elected school board trustees who get big bucks, ha-ha, they don't even get paid, and they do a ton of work for the good of all. So where's the local control? And as a colleague across the aisle just said, I think this bill is unconstitutional. It's probably going to die by fiscal note or the fact that it goes to court. So I think this much ado about nothing. We haven't really had a problem, so I'm going to be voting no on this one.
Representative Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, members, the purpose of this bill is to save women's sports and protect their access to a fair and level playing field. From individuals who were born as male and now claim they are female. There is no hint of discrimination in this bill. It leaves intact the ability for a school to enact a co-ed or transports team. This doesn't bar anyone from sports entirely, as the opposition keeps claiming. In some cases, nowadays, men change their gender daily, which is known as gender fluid. Gender fluid is where a person can wake up one day and say, I'm a man today, and wake up the next morning and say, I'm a female today. The term gender fluid is becoming a commonality in today's society, which is fine. They can identify as and be who they want to be. But in some cases, you're using this as a tactic to win in sports. Let's just say the divisional tournament is coming up for the mile. A man who may have not done so well during the season and has no shot at placing for the state championship, he can go, well, I'm going to identify as a female today and easily qualify for the women's state championship, then go on to compete in the women's state championship and potentially even take first place. Stories like these are becoming a commonality across the world, and it's ruining women's sports. Just look at the facts. Men have larger hearts and lungs. Men have more muscle and larger bones. Men have a greater amount of fast-twitch muscle fibers, which give men more explosive power. Just simply compare the fastest mile time ever ran by a man and compare it to a woman. It proves that men have a much higher potential of being substantially faster. As a 20-year-old, I have hundreds of friends in collegiate and high school sports all around the state. Every single one of them, Republican and Democrat, that I've spoken to have stated their support for HB 112. But they can't speak up on campus about it because of the backlash they will receive. This topic should not be controversial. This is the most pro-women legislation to be introduced this session. Our colleagues on the other side claim to be pro-women, and if they really are, they'd support this.
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to speak to the bill.
Representative Mercer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the body, a couple of the previous speakers have talked about the legal implications of this bill, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what I have reviewed and my conclusions, which ultimately lead me to support House Bill 112. We are following in the wake of our friends to the west. Idaho passed a statute that is quite comparable to what we consider today. And in fact, as has been foreshadowed, litigation has ensued. The district court in Idaho did enjoin the statute, so it is now pending in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And it's important for you to know that the state of Montana has appeared as an amicus in that case, supporting the statute that Idaho passed. It's also important for you to know that the United States Department of Justice, through its Civil Rights Division, has filed a brief, an amicus brief, in support of Idaho. And let me read you verbatim a few of the things that I think are important for you to consider. The brief joined by our previous Attorney General starts off by saying, the amici states have an interest in preserving their freedom when addressing important policy issues, including the best way to promote equal opportunities for female student athletes and to ensure fairness in women's high school and college sports. The United States Department of Justice says a number of things that are important and that I think we need to seriously consider. The first thing they say is the injunction by the district court in Idaho also harms biological females by depriving them of equal athletic opportunities, by forcing them to compete on unequal footing against biological males. The Equal Protection Clause does not require states to abandon their efforts to provide biological women with equal opportunity to participate in and enjoy the lifelong benefits that flow from school athletics in order to accommodate the team preferences of transgender athletes. Indeed, the district court's decision harms the women that Congress desired to protect when it enacted Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, which prohibits sex discrimination by federal funding recipients. They go on to say, indeed, it is the district court's injunction which creates a special exception allowing biological males to compete on female sports teams if and only if they are transgender that discriminates on the basis of transgender status. And then finally, speaking to the point made by my colleague from Missoula County, he invoked the Bostock decision and the recent decision by the Biden administration. And here's what the Civil Rights Division said about that in November 2020. Bostock 2 addressed only the question whether an employee under Title VII may fire an employee, quote, simply for being homosexual or transgender, close quote, and, quote, allegedly for no reason other than the employee's homosexuality or transgender status, close quote. None of these other federal laws prohibiting sexual discrimination are before us. We do not prejudge any such questions today. Under Title VII, too, we do not purport to address bathrooms, locker rooms, or anything else of the kind. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. So the idea that if we pass this statute, it is incompatible with Bostock is certainly not or preordained by the decision in Bostock. Finally, in terms of facial neutrality, by contrast, the Fairness Act, statute passed by Idaho, is facially non-discriminatory with respect to transgender status. Males, regardless of transgender status, are permitted to participate in athletic competitions only on the teams corresponding to their biological sex. The fact that transgender individuals may disproportionately not wish to do so does not mean that they are prohibited from doing so. So I think the legal construct, I don't disagree with those that say it's likely that we'll see litigation here, but I think if you're voting a green light, you can be confident that there are legal arguments that substantiate the position that you are voting for in favor today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ferris Olson.
Mr. Chair, members of the body, thank you. And I just felt we needed a brief response to what was just said. I appreciate that there was an in-depth legal discussion, and I appreciate that we will disagree. There in competing legal opinions from the state of Montana, and those are the plaintiffs in the Idaho suit. But thus far, those held by my good friend from Billings have been on the losing side, whether it's in Bostock or in Idaho. Those cases lost. Transgender individuals are protected under the Equal Protection Clause, and they will continue to be so. And I think we lose sight of what the economic and where the economic damage is going to come from. It's not simply because of the violations of the Constitution. It's because there's an executive order now saying that they will go after states that discriminate on the basis of gender identity. And President Biden will certainly be more proactive about that than we've seen in the past. And in the past, when anti-transgender bills have been passed, the Department of Justice has gone after those states. I mean, the best example is North Carolina with their bathroom bill. The Department of Justice sued North Carolina. So let's be honest. The opinions espoused by my good friend so far have been rejected basically at every turn. And the federal government has sued states that have tried to discriminate on the basis of gender identity. So let's not make that mistake here, and let's reject this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There being no further discussion, does the sponsor wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The legal aspect and the threat of lawsuits is always used when a moral issue is brought up and people believe strongly on one side or the other. Let's look at what we have in common here. We are trying, in this bill, to protect women's athletic opportunities. Now, I can probably fairly say that I have more experience in supporting women's athletics than any other member of this chamber, because I began supporting and coaching women's athletics in 1973. I have had the blessings to have young female athletes that went on to win gold medals in international competition. They could not compete against an old, gray-haired, old man coach. The opportunities that Title IX has done for America have been phenomenal. Phenomenal. Women getting the assertions of success. And so the elephant in the room is, they always talk about, well, the NCAA or federal suing or lack of federal funds. The reality is that it is time for the great sovereign state of Montana to make a statement that this protects women's sports. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The question now arises on the motion of Representative Fuller that when this committee does rise and report after having had under consideration House Bill 112, it recommend the same do pass. Those in favor of the motion vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Are there absentee votes?
None, Mr. Chair.
Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Chair, 62 representatives have voted aye, 38 have voted no.
House Bill 112 has passed second reading. Members of the committee, you have before you for your consideration House Bill 113. The clerk will read the title of the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 113, introduced by Fuller, a bill for an act entitled, an act providing for youth health protection, providing definitions, prohibiting certain medications and medical procedures for the treatment of gender dysphoria in minors, and providing for enforcement.
What is your pleasure, Representative Fuller?
Mr. Chair, I move when this committee does rise and report after having had under discussion House Bill 113 or 113, that I recommend the same, do pass, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body. House Bill 113, the Youth Health Protection Act, is designed to protect children from the administration of drugs and chemicals and from the imposition of surgical procedures for the purpose of causing the child to physically appear more like a person of the opposite sex and less like his or her own sex, or to conform to a gender identity incongruent with the child's sex. Children live under the guardianship of adults precisely because they lack the maturity, prudence, and experience to make safe, responsible decisions for themselves. When gender dysphoria is in the mix, these decisions can have lifelong consequences. Many of the biological effects of testosterone and hormone therapy cannot be reversed, ever. Additionally, gender transition involving major surgeries can
can not only result in sterility, but other irreversible negative biological effects. More importantly, there is no evidence from any long-term studies that medical transitions reduce gender dysphoria or suicidality. If a wounded and mentally ill veteran decided that he identified with a legless amputee, no one would ever entertain his desire to cut off his legs. Instead, he would be treated differently with compassion for the cause of his misguided wishes. A child exhibiting similar body dissatisfaction needs care, compassion, counseling, and guidance addressing the real cause of the distress. Every child deserves a natural childhood, one that allows them to experience puberty and other normal changes that shape who they will become. But there is nothing natural or healthy about pumping children full of puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones or performing sterilizing surgeries on them. We do not allow children to make all kinds of unhealthy decisions. Smoking, drinking, child pornography, sex with adults, and illegal drug use. The freedom to make decisions does not allow us to determine the consequences of these decisions. Children should be free from either parental, peer, or cultural pressure to deal with their gender dysphoria by starting down a one-way road to lifelong medical intervention. Please join me in protecting children and allow them to progress into adulthood free from this danger. I recommend a do pass.
Is there discussion? Representative Ferris Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you once again for giving me the opportunity to speak. I rise in opposition to House Bill 113 for many of the same reasons you've already heard, most importantly because of its negative economic impact and its unconstitutionality. First, House Bill 113 sends the wrong message about Montana, that would rather legalize discrimination than grow our economy. We've seen countless examples where states seek to discriminate against transgender individuals only to face economic backlash. North Carolina's bathroom bill is the best example, with a nationwide backlash. Adidas, PayPal, Deutsche Bank all stubborn plans for expansion. Musicians, including Bruce Springsteen, canceled concerts. The NBA moved its All-Star game. The NCAA initially moved March Madness out of the state. And other states announced bans on publicly
Representative
funded
Ferris Olson?
Yes.
I think we need to stick to the bill a little bit closer, please.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. We always need to look at the impacts of our actions. And this is a pretty significant one when North Carolina faced a backlash of approximately $3.76 billion, 3,000 and 3,000 jobs in the 12 years following the passage of House Bill 2. This bill, in comparison, is much more insidious, and we risk the same kind of economic retaliation. We can't afford to tell our business owners, medical professionals, and parents that discrimination of this sort is okay. Secondly, this bill is facially unconstitutional, violating both the U.S. and Montana constitutional guarantees of equal protection and Montana's right to privacy. Just last summer, Justice Gorsuch, writing for the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court, explained that discriminating based on the gender identity is a prohibited form of sex discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Montana's Constitution has an even higher standard under equal protection, so it certainly violates Montana's Constitution as well. Beyond that, Montana has a fundamental right to privacy we've discussed multiple times today. In the Armstrong case that's been mentioned before, the court held that there's a fundamental right to privacy, including the right one's right to choose or refuse medical treatment. Those sorts of decisions are, as the court described, protected under the personal autonomy component of the individual privacy guarantees of Montana's Constitution, and properly so. Few matters more directly implicate personal autonomy and individual privacy than medical judgments affecting one's bodily integrity and health. Not only did the court find this find that privacy was protected, but even in the fiscal note, the Department of Labor stated that this may be a violation of a person's right to privacy. And so to the extent that Department of Labor recognizes it, the Montana Supreme Court recognizes it, and the U.S. Supreme Court recognizes the blatant unconstitutionality of this bill, I would ask you all to recognize as well and uphold your oath to those constitutions. But beyond the economic and constitutional troubles, This bill strikes home for me as a father of two young children. My kids are 2 and 4, and while I don't think they're transgender, I can't be sure. But whether I'm right or wrong doesn't matter. I always want to prioritize what is right for my kids. We've heard from hundreds of parents who are trying to do the same. They know their families and what is right for them. So I urge this body to vote no on House Bill 113. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Custer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the body, for indulging me 2 times, but you shouldn't have put all the hot button issues on one day. You already know I'm older than dirt, so I've also been a Republican when it wasn't cool to be a Republican in the 60s and 70s. All those years, the principles of the party were drilled into my head. Less taxes, less regulation, and ensuring personal freedoms. This bill, to me, flies in the face of 2 of these. We're doing more regulation. We're coming between the doctor and the patient. We're telling the doctor who he can treat, who he can't, after he's had a 6-digit education and spent hours before he can even see a patient. But the most egregious to me is my personal freedom to be a parent. When you become a parent, you don't take it lightly. Your kids are your most important, valuable thing, and you give up your life for them. So do you think as a parent that if I've got a kid that's going through puberty and struggling, I'm not going to get the best care I can possibly afford for them and go with whatever is happening? Science evolves. Think about it. Years ago, some of the mental health things were lobotomies. Look how it's changed. I had a doctor for a neighbor. He'd been our doctor for 30-some years. He was always taking online classes and going to seminars because he felt like, as an older medical doctor, things were evolving so much quicker than they were when he got out of medical school. He had to keep up with that. So to me, this bill is telling me as a parent that I wouldn't be making the right decision for my kid. And I know that when you go to do any kind of mental health thing, it takes a while. Even if you've got anxiety or depression or something that can be treated with a medicine and counseling, it takes a while for the medicine to take effect. It may not work for that particular one. Might not work. You might have to try something else. This is just not a quick one-shot deal that I'm going to go in and, oh, I'm going to get this done and my child's going to be immediately better. It's not going to work like that. This is going to be a long, well-thought-out, planned-out thing. It's not going to be something quick. And sometimes these drugs are getting charged with, they won't do the trick. Sometimes it's just giving that child time, the way I understand it from these drugs and all the doctors that contacted me on this, that it gives them time so that they can make an informed decision. And no surgery is going to be made on a kid until they're old enough to do that decision themselves, the way it was explained to me by a good doctor from Billings that treats kids. So I don't think you can take a unique medical problem and solve it with a religiously charged political decision. So if I haven't made myself clear enough, I'll be a no.
Minority Leader Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise in opposition to House Bill 113. It undermines healthcare providers' ability to provide medically necessary care to Montana kids. For folks that have trans people in their family, the transition-related care is crucial. It can be life-saving. And it should be noted that this is a hard day for the trans people in my family. But banning these medically recommended protocols prohibits healthcare professionals from making the best decisions for their patients. That's the bottom line. You know, this bill was amended in committee, but unfortunately it took the bill from bad to worse. And reporting physicians to state licensing boards is more serious and could have a potentially bigger financial impact on medical providers than the original fines in the bill. And the enforcement outlined could actually bar them from practicing medicine in the state of Montana at all. That is a hefty penalty for doing your job, and it's a hefty penalty for providing life-saving care. That's why you heard from so many doctors. That's why you heard from so many associations. This is a dangerous bill, and I hope that its trajectory ends on this floor today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Thank
Mr. Chairman, I rise in support of House B 113 for the following reasons. Changing a person's external sexual characteristics can never solve a mental health or psychological problem. Sex does not equal gender, and you cannot solve a gender problem by changing a person's physical body. The other reason is a child is not equipped with the legal standing or the maturity to make this life-altering decision. Mr. Chairman, life is sacred, and all of our children are precious and valuable just as they are. And under no circumstances can I support invasive techniques or procedures that render a child infertile for life or irreparably change their natural body. Sex change procedures and surgeries are not shown to be safe or reversible. Data does not show that a child's overall mental health is improved by this imposed process. But we do know, and we did hear in committee, that many people regret this irreversible process. A person did testify in our committee on this bill that they regretted the process to the point of going through an attempted reversal, which will never render her to be whole in her own eyes. There is not long-term safety data, nor enough information about the effects of hormone treatment on other body systems, including normal brain development of adolescents. We must affirm the value of Montana's children by accepting that each of their young lives has value right now. They do not need to be fixed, and they do not need to conform to societal standards of interests or preferences. I rise in support of this bill to protect children and to affirm the value of our children as they are fearfully and wonderfully made and to protect them from irreversible, life-destroying procedures and surgeries.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise in support of House Bill 113. There's been a lot of things discussed and put on the table, and I'd like to just bring it back to what this bill is about. And this bill is not about restricting rights or restricting anything other than having in our minds that we are here to protect minor children from what are lifelong physical and psychological impacts of what is an elective medical procedure. There's been some discussion about the Constitution, and just to read it real quick, not the whole thing, but one article, Article 2, Section 15, says, "The rights of persons under 18 years of age shall include, but not be limited to, all the fundamental rights of this article, unless specifically precluded by laws which enhance the protection of such persons." We all know that many laws exist, they've been mentioned already, which apply to children for their protection, but do not apply to adults. These life-altering elective procedures which seek to alter the biological processes of children are not appropriate. Adults are responsible for preventing children from making life-altering decisions that they may regret in adulthood. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Putnam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to speak to the bill.
Representative Putnam.
I guess I'd just like to kind of point out that a lot of times these procedures are mainly hormonal treatments. They're essentially there to delay puberty in the children, which essentially gives them a longer time period in order to make an informed decision versus having us decide that decision for them without being able to make a choice, you know, their parents and doctors also agree with. Thank you.
Representative Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
First, I'd just like to start off by saying that this is not a straightforward issue for me. It's been really challenging. It's kept me up at night. And one of the reasons it's kept me up at night is these are my patients, right? You know, I've cared for even a four-year-old who identified with not his his gender. And so these are my families. They're the kids I've cared for. They're the adults that I cared for. So I'm emotionally connected to it. And being emotionally connected to it was difficult, right? Because it starts to cloud your thinking. So I won't try and convince you one way or another. I'll just try and articulate to you how I got to where I am. Some of you might be familiar with the UK case. So in the UK right now, they have stopped providing any of the hormones, the puberty blockers, and of course surgery for anyone under 16 years of age. If you're 16 years and not an adult, then you'll have to go before the court, and a judge is going to help decide whether you would move forward or not. And so it basically comes down, at least for me, to informed consent. And so I'll walk you through a little bit about how we might think about the informed consent process. The first thing to understand is, like the good representative said about the puberty blockers, this is a very confusing issue, right? But that's not the intervention that you want to focus in on. The one that you want to focus in on is the cross-sex hormones. Because once you get to the cross-sex hormones, that phase is irreversible. Forever. And it's things like inability to orgasm, it's things like being infertile, having to have your eggs removed and then find a sperm donor and have those frozen into time in case you want to have babies when you're older. So it's really the cross-sex hormones that we have to worry about. And we've been told by many physicians that in fact they use the puberty blockers to just pause. And so the real question that you need to ask yourself is, of the children who start the puberty blockers, what percent of them do not move on to the cross-section hormones? And so I'll go through a little mathematics for you, for some of you who might be mathematically challenged from the common core mathematics that you went through. If you had 100 children who were diagnosed with gender dysphoria, of that 100 children, 80 of them, so 80% of those kids, would eventually go on to not have the diagnosis of gender dysphoria. They would course correct. I'm not saying that they might be gay, there might be other things going on, but they are going to bounce back from the gender dysphoria diagnosis, so 80 of those kids. If you start that same 100 children on puberty blockers, essentially 100% of those kids are going to go on to cross-sex hormones. I mean, the real number is like 98.3%. So essentially 100%. 100% of the kids, all 100 of those kids, if you start them on puberty blockers, are going to move on. And so now you've taken 80 of the children and you've moved them into the irreversible puberty blocker realm when otherwise they wouldn't have done so. So back to the UK case. So the UK case, I'll just read a couple of pieces from it. They got really to the place where the panel of judges decided that, in fact, a child cannot give informed consent, and I'll read just a small section from you. The adolescents find it difficult to contemplate or comprehend what their life will be like as adults, and that they do not always consider the longer-term consequences of their actions. Perhaps this statement is obvious. Although a child may understand the concept of loss of fertility, for example, this is not the same as understanding how this will affect them in their adult life.
1 minute.
And finally, they ultimately decided there is no age-appropriate way to explain to many of these children what losing their fertility or full sexual function may mean to them in later years. And I'll just remind you that there's many examples of times when medicine and science gets it wrong, right? Many, many examples of this. From being on blood thinner, we used to, like, when you were needed a tooth taken out and you were on blood thinners, like high-dose ones, we would take you off of that, give you a drug holiday, and then take the tooth out. But then we found that that actually gives you more stroke and heart attack. Same with hormone replacement in women. That was the standard of care for 20 years until we found out that that gave you more heart attacks and stroke. And let's not forget that thalidomide was given to women for the purposes of morning sickness until we had babies born without limbs. And so you have to understand that this, as the UK court decided as well, is experimental at best with unknown risks and unknown benefits. And I'll just leave you with that. Thank you.
Representative Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, those who are have served with me before know that addressing mental health in our state is really important to me. I think I'm not alone in that. I would offer that many share that. And so I really want to bring to the attention of the body that there are over 50 high-quality studies that have shown that youth who receive gender-affirming care reduce their suicide rate by up to 70%. And when you hear references to those youth who will go on to receive care that helps them then make that cross-gender affirmation, they're moving out of puberty arrest and they're actually making that hormonal change, it speaks very specifically to the high quality of care that they are receiving by trained physicians in this area of practice who are providing the appropriate screening, that are just not willy-nilly providing that care for every youth that comes to them who is struggling with these issues, but carefully following, tracking, and only recommending steps forward for those that they know are prepared for it. And so what we know on the other side of that is that the vast majority that go on after having received that care do not regret their decision. And those are the ones that we're here fighting for today. Thank you.
There being no further discussion, does the sponsor wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, this emotional discussion illustrates that there is every single one of us, all 100 members of this body, have a serious and deep concern for the welfare of our children. I do not see this bill, 113, as discriminatory, nor do I see it as unconstitutional. It is another tool by which we can protect children. And by protecting them, we are not denying them care, compassion, counseling, whatever. We are only telling them that they need to have the opportunity to reach adulthood before they are subjected to decisions that will affect their lives forever. Members of the body, every single one of us loves our children here in Montana. I urge it to pass.
The question now arises on the motion of Representative Fuller that when this committee does rise and report after having had under consideration House Bill 113, it recommend the same do pass. Those in favor of the motion vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Are there absentee votes?
None, Mr. Chair.
Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Chair, 53 representatives have voted aye. 47 have voted no.
House Bill 113 is passed second reading. Chair recognizes Majority Leader Benton.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee rise and report.
You have heard the motion of Majority Leader Benton. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it, and so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, we are Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration business on second reading, recommend as follows.
Mr. Speaker, I move adoption of the committee report.
You've heard the motion to adopt the committee report. All those in favor will vote aye. All those opposed will vote no. The clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Speaker, 89 representatives have voted aye. 7 have voted no.
The committee report has been adopted. Thank you, Representative Casey Knutson. Order business number 8, third reading of bills.
Mr. Speaker, House Bill 22, introduced by Garner, a bill for an act entitled Allow In-Kind Services for Easement on State Land Used for Military Facilities.
House Bill 22, having read three several times, the question is, shall the bill be passed by the House? Those in favor vote aye. Those opposed vote no. Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Speaker, 100 representatives have voted aye.
House Bill 22 has passed the House.
Mr. Speaker, House Bill 26, introduced by Funk, a bill for an act entitled Clarify the Definition of Pupil.
House Bill 26, having read three several times, the question is, shall the bill be passed by the House? Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Speaker, 95 representatives have voted aye. 5 have voted no.
House Bill 26 has passed the House.
Mr. Speaker, House Bill 32, introduced by Vinton, a bill for an act entitled Repeat Ending Fund Balance Limits for School District Funds.
House Bill 32, having read three several times, the question is, should the bill be passed by the House? Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Speaker, 99 representatives have voted aye. 0 have voted no.
House Bill 32 has passed the House.
Mr. Speaker, House Bill 153, introduced by Fitzgerald, a bill for an act entitled Revised Professional Liability Insurance Requirements for Real Estate Licensees.
House Bill 153, ever read three several times. The question is, should the bill be passed by the House? Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote? If not, the clerk will record the vote.
Mr. Speaker, 100 representatives have voted aye.
House Bill 153 has passed the House.
That is all, Mr. Speaker.
Order of business number 9, motions. Seeing none. Order of business number 10, unfinished business.
None, Mr. Speaker.
Order of business number 11, special orders of the day.
None, Mr. Speaker.
Order of business number 12, announcement of committee meetings. Representative Lenz.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Human Services will not be meeting today. We will not be meeting. Thank you.
Representative Bartel.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. General Government will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m., room 350.
Representative Burgley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Education will meet immediately upon adjournment.
Representative Gunderson.
Mr. Speaker, House Natural Resources will convene right after adjournment.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Section F tomorrow morning, 8:30 a.m.
Representative McCamey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House State Administration will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room 455 for bills. Mr. Speaker.
Representative Skies.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Energy will not meet today. Mr. Speaker, may I rise on a point of order, please?
So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members of the body, excellent job today. I just want to salute the chamber. But I do want to suggest that we do have a freshman member who had her first bill before this chamber. Even though it was contentious, for us to clap at it at that time might have been inappropriate. I'd just like to remind the speaker. Thank you.
So noted. Representative Custer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Local Government, tomorrow, 3 o'clock, room 472, two bills and two executive action.
Representative Cashmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Ag, tomorrow, 3 o'clock, room 137, two bills.
Representative Matt Regeer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Section B, tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, 102.
Representative Beattie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Section E meets tomorrow morning, 8:30, 472, to complete hearings on post-secondary education budgets.
Representative Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Section C will not meet tomorrow. We will meet Wednesday at 8:30, room 317C.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Taxation meets tomorrow morning at 8:30. We have LFD revenue update and three bills. Thank you.
Representative Logie.
Speaker, transportation, right upon adjournment, we'll earn our money today. Two bills, one executive action.
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Section D, tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, 317A.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There is no House appropriations today.
Representative Usher.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Judiciary, 8 a.m., 137. We held out on some executive today because everybody said there was amendments coming and nobody's gone to see bill drafters to get them done. So get them done, please.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Business and Labor tomorrow morning, 8:30. Many bills.
Minority Leader Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question on why House Bill 113 wasn't re-referred to appropriations. It has a fiscal impact of over $100,000 over the biennium.
Representative, I believe the net is under $100,000. So that is why it's skipping appropriations.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Curdy.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to confirm with the vote tally that my vote on 113 was a no. It didn't show on my computer.
Are you asking to change your vote?
No, I'm asking to see if it was recorded.
We're checking. It was.
Thank you, sir.
Majority Leader Vinton.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn and reconvene Tuesday, the 17th legislative day at 1 p.m.
You've heard the motion of Majority Leader Vinton. All those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. The House will reconvene at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, January 26th. The House is adjourned.